Safety first, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Myanmar and Bangladesh sign a deal for the return of Rohingya refugees to Myanmar. But what about the violence that those refugees fled from?
First of all, obviously, is safety. Our concern is that they will be safe from the kind of violence that they fled.
Meanwhile, Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh continue to grow.
5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, this was a forest that's now become people's home, you know, sheet by sheet of corrugated iron, of bamboo walls.
And later, are Norwegian, Danish, and Swedish really different languages?
So sometimes there's a joke that Norwegian is Danish spoken with a Swedish accent. So that's how close they all are.
That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday, Thanksgiving Day here in the U.S. We're going to start off today's show in Bangladesh. That's where more than 500,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to. The Rohingya people are a Muslim ethnic minority, and they've been fleeing violence in Myanmar that U.S. officials now describe as ethnic cleansing. Today, Bangladesh signed an agreement with Myanmar for the return of the Rohingya. We wanted to hear more about this deal and how it could work from someone who's been on the ground as this refugee crisis has unfolded. So we reached out to Carolyn Miles. She's with the charity group Save the Children, and she just returned from an aid trip to Bangladesh.
My understanding of the agreement is that there will be very small numbers repatriated. It would take, in fact, years for people to go back. So there's going to be a crisis in this area of Bangladesh for many years to come.
Do the Rohingyas, do they get to choose who wants to return, or will some simply be sent back?
I believe that the idea is they'll get to choose, and I think it's unlikely you'll have a lot of people choosing right now, given what they went through when they were in Myanmar, to return. I don't know that that's really going to happen.
At this point, do you think that the Rohingya Muslims who fled their country to escape violence will be better off because of this deal? I mean, is it in their interest to return at this point?
You know, I think it's tough to say that. I was there a couple years ago, and at that time in the central state of Rakhine, hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas were living there, and they were living in really difficult situations and conditions, living in IDP camps. Their movements were very restricted, so they didn't have the ability to actually move around, and the conditions were quite tough. So I don't know that this agreement is actually going to give them either the rights of movement or that the conditions are going to be much better than what they fled.
Do you have a sense of how the Rohingya Muslims who are in Bangladesh now are responding to the deal? I mean, are they interested or wary?
Well, I think they're going to be quite wary. In talking to families, and we sat and talked with many of the families in the camp, in the settlements, and, you know, when we asked them about going back, they had this look of fear, I would say, on their faces. And given what they've been through, I think that's quite natural. And none of them said that they thought that they would be able to go back anytime soon. This was before the deal was signed. So I do think they're going to be very wary of going back.
What do you have to hear about the details of this deal to think that it's a good idea? I mean, are there issues that you want the deal to address before any Rohingyas head back?
Well, I think the most important thing that would have to be addressed is that those returning, they would have to have some ability to move within the Rakhine state, and they would need to have their basic needs met. So would there be food available, healthcare available for them? Would they be able to work inside of these areas, wherever it is that they're going to be resettled? So I think just basic rights and needs are the most important things for these families that are going back. And, you know, protection of the population, the violence and the burning of villages and all of the things that have happened to them while they've been there. Certainly, there'd have to be protection against those things. And the military would have to agree that there were going to be protective conditions for these people.
Carolyn Miles, she's president and CEO of Save the Children. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
The port town of Cox's Bazar is a famously beautiful tourist spot in the southeast corner of Bangladesh. It's also where a mega camp of Rohingya refugees has sprung up, according to Shelley Thackrell. She's with the United Nations World Food Program.
5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, this was a forest that's now become people's home. You know, sheet by sheet of corrugated iron, of bamboo walls. You know, families live side by side. Some families are fivefold. Some families are up to eight and more.
Shelley, I looked this place up, Cox's Bazar, where you are. It's right on the coast. It looks like a big beach town. Describe where you are.
Carol, you're absolutely right. It actually hosts some of the most beautiful beach coastline, 125 kilometers. It's probably the longest beach coastline in the world. You drive one way and to your right is this never-ending marine drive with the coast and the sand to the right. And then the camps themselves are an hour from where most of us stay in town. And the camp has just grown. It's grown exponentially. It's, you know, it's now what we call a mega camp. And the Bangladesh government has been really gracious, has really opened their borders to these people who are fleeing.
I know this corridor has been a place where you mentioned, you know, for years now, Rohingya refugees have come to this part of Bangladesh. Are there Rohingya refugees there in Cox's Bazar who've been there for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years?
I mean, there are people here that have been here for 25 years, since the late 90s as well. You're seeing now a generation of families, of Rohingya families who've been here for 25 years, for 2 years.
So it's now Cox's Bazar has really become their home. They're kind of settled there, many Rohingyas. Any other particular story of a particular refugee and their personal story that might bring home for us what life is really like for these refugees when they come from Myanmar?
We've recently conducted a study which says that one in four Rohingya children is suffering from malnutrition. And this is, you know, food is not enough to beat malnutrition. You know, we need to improve health on all levels, sanitation and hygiene, as well as the quality of nutrition. So if, you know, if you can imagine these some 700,000 families living side by side in such a close proximity in this mega camp. And we're in the dry season now. We're in a season now where we probably have 3 or 4 months where the weather is on our side. But, you know, but there is always a potential of cyclones here. Once the monsoon starts, you know, that's where roads become impassable. It becomes very difficult to navigate the roads here.
That just has to be dramatic. I had no idea that there were so many hundreds of thousands concentrated in one small area. I imagine that Rohingya refugees, when they came into Bangladesh, were going to different places.
And this is the challenge. I mean, the challenge is the mega camp. The challenge is clean water, is sanitation, is disease. UNICEF is currently conducting a measles campaign. You know, there are pockets of the camp which are probably more prone to, you know, open water where water will just sit. The weather has actually, in the last few days, it's dropped significantly in terms of the temperature. You know, a week ago, the days were just baking. It was heavy, heavy sun. And, you know, families make this treacherous journey by foot from Myanmar, escaping the persecution there. Some tell us that they've walked for 6 days, they've walked for 10 days, they've walked with, you know, just the bare possessions that they have. So there are people arriving every day, and we're trying to kind of get life-saving food to them. We get biscuits to them. We get hot meals to them. They're given shelter. So, you know, we're trying to do everything to really make sure that, you know, whatever trauma that they've encountered, that they have something here which helps them settle into something that's dignified, into something that makes them feel welcome and makes them feel that they are being looked after.
The UN World Food Program's Shelley Thackrell. She's based in Cox's Bazar in the southeastern corner of Bangladesh along the border with Myanmar. Thanks so much, Shelley.
Thank you.
In the mid-1970s, thousands of indigenous Hmong people started coming to the U.S. They were refugees from the Vietnam War. Many of them settled in Minnesota, now home to a large Hmong community. Ye Vang is part of this story. He came to the U.S. as a refugee, and today he's a chef specializing in Hmong cooking. But being a culinary emissary can get tricky. Here's reporter Nancy Rosenbaum of KFAI Radio in Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Her rice is ready to roll, brother.
It's a rainy, miserable afternoon, but Chef Ye Vang isn't complaining. He's cooking outside under a white tent.
We don't have much to complain about. Our parents had a cross the Mekong River to get here. A little rain never really hurt anybody.
Fang is Hmong and co-runs a catering business that specializes in Hmong cuisine. Today they're serving Hmong elders and younger people at a farm. Fang is prepping sticky rice, roasted vegetables, and grilled meats.
Grab the chicken out, and we can lay the chicken on.
Fang wants to share stories about the Hmong people through food. The Hmong have never had their own country, and for generations they lived as nomadic farmers in Southeast Asia and China. But Fang, who's 33, has spent most of his life in the Midwest. Eating cheese curds is part of his Hmong story, too. So as a chef, Fang has struggled to prove himself to some Hmong elders, who he says are skeptical of his take on traditional food. Case in point, two older Hmong farmers watch as Fang cooks chickens over a wood-fired grill. Soon, they start asking him questions. Fang translates the conversation for me.
What did they say?
They were like, oh, this isn't done. The flame's not big enough. It's like, how is this ever going to be done on time?
Fang's cousin and business partner, Chris Hurt, chimes in.
Is there more food?
Is this it? And, you know, like, I'm so used to it now.
So, like, if we were at a Hmong party, it would be, like, all of our aunts.
It would be all our aunts.
Telling us how to cook it.
Yeah.
Fang moved to the U.S. when he was about 5. His parents didn't speak English and held strong to Hmong traditions, including food. So while other kids played Little League, Fang's dad taught him how to butcher a pig and grill meat over an open flame.
To be given the tong to grill or flip the meat was like this huge kind of rite of passage. And when I was young, my dad, like, I think he had to run in and go grab something, and he handed me the tongs, and I was just like, what? And literally, I was just like, okay, like, don't mess it up.
Later, Fang worked at restaurants in the Twin Cities, and he's now trying to put his own stamp on Hmong cuisine, like adding beets to his dishes.
What do you have here?
We have a fire-roasted beets, carrots, and onions. So it's all root vegetables.
Even though many of the farmers Fang's serving tonight grow beets, Fang says that Hmong people usually don't eat them.
We get a lot of our own people will criticize and say, well, that's not Hmong food. Like, why would you use beets? Hmong people don't use beets. And I would challenge them, and I said, you know, when our parents and our grandparents lived in Laos and Thailand, they used what was around them because it was about survival. And us being here in the northern Midwest, wouldn't we do the same thing?
This is Hmong style, so...
Yeah.
Finally, it's time to eat. Fang wonders if the elders will appreciate his twist on Hmong food.
It's fun to watch the reaction in the face, like, especially with the older generation, especially, like, that roasted vegetable dish. It's just like, okay. Like, so you're like, will they like it or not?
Before long, the food is gone, and some of the farmers return to the fields wearing bright headlamps. Fang stays behind and chats with his friend Tico. He tells her about his signature hot sauce. If you've eaten Hmong food, then you'll know that pepper sauce is key.
Tico, do you know what we call our hot sauce?
What do you guys call it?
We've labeled it a tiger bite sauce.
What? Dude, that's a bomb name.
It turns out that tiger bite has a particular meaning for Hmong people.
The literal translation of tiger bite is like the worst curse you can give somebody. It's like a bad word. Like, I can't even to this day say it in Hmong. And I still don't have the heart to tell my parents that it's called tiger bite sauce. I'm just like, oh yeah, it's just our pepper sauce. So weird. But a lot of our like non-Hmong speaking people are like, oh, I get it because it has a bite, right? We're like, yeah, because it's got a bite.
Fang wants to sell his tiger bite sauce. He also wants to open his own restaurant, just like his nomadic Hmong ancestors. He's looking for a permanent place to call home. For the World, Nancy Rosenbaum, Hastings, Minnesota.
Support for this podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. Some of the most important questions facing the world today intersect with the global capital markets. Climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth. On Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast, you'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like these, plus much more. Think of it as a place to get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.